is Justice John Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and to her left, Justice David Prosser, and on the far left, Justice Lewis Butler. With those introductions made, we will begin our first oral argument on the March calendar, and that is 02-2448, Patricia Zmrozek versus Intra Financial Corporation. Arguing on behalf of the plaintiff's appellant petitioners, Patricia Zmrozek, is attorney William P. Skemp. Mr. Skemp.
Thank you, Your Honor. And please, the court. This is a legal malpractice case which has developed some rather unique issues as a result of the proceedings that took place during the course of the representation by the attorneys of my client, Ms. Zmrozek. The attorneys were hired to do all of the legal work associated with putting a motel project together. It involved the raising of funds, it involved the preparing of documentation, etc. The defendant's brief rightfully says that there are many disputed facts between the parties as to the nature and extent of the representation, etc. From the standpoint of my client, she wanted these attorneys to represent her in all respects with regard to this project. And to that end, she began to raise money to fund it. She raised the money in some $500,000. And after the money, that initial money was raised, the attorneys then prepared a memorandum offering to submit to the Securities and Exchange Commission for purposes of raising additional monies.
Oh, counsel, can I just on those facts so that I'm clear, the first $500,000 was raised with just notes. Now, there's some argument or dispute that the law firm, Mallory and Zimmerman, they did not participate in those first notes. In other words, they drafted different notes which offered security in the property. Is that?
Well, Your Honor, there is a dispute as to whether or not they participated and had knowledge of the raising of those notes. From the standpoint of my client, there is no question that they knew that those monies were being raised. She drafted some of the notes. They were not artfully drafted. And at a later time, in order to clean up the mess, the law firm then redrafted those notes, making the same obligor on the notes, and at that time prepared some mortgages which secured those notes. That's part of the problem, because at the time that the client was raising the money, she clearly states that they knew that she was raising that money, and that they knew that it was essential for this project to go ahead, but not only that $500,000 be raised, but that there would have to be some additional monies to be raised in addition to bank financing. When the notes and the mortgages were redrafted by the law firm, and they didn't redraft them because it was something new, they redrafted them because they wanted them all to be consistent. They wanted all to have the same obligor, and they wanted them all to have a secured interest. The problem with that was that, meanwhile, back at the ranch, there had been a problem with the contractor, and the contractor had filed a claim for lien. That lien was not challenged by the law firm, and as a result of that failure to challenge that, the lien foreclosure went through, and then when the notes and mortgages were drafted, they came behind that lien claim. So when this public memorandum was then prepared, the problems were, number one, there were misstatements in the memorandum with regard to the fact that the plaintiff had three securities licenses. She hadn't. She had turned those licenses in. There was a huge dispute about that. They said, well, we didn't know anything about those licenses. And she said, absolutely, you did. You knew I turned them in. She was not given a copy of the first public memorandum which contained that information. So she was unaware of the fact that that misinformation was contained in that public memorandum. We produced an expert who stated that there was no question in his mind that those lien claims that had been made were not properly claimed and that they should have been challenged and they should not have been of record at the time that this public memorandum came forward. But they were of record, they hadn't been challenged, and therefore that was a second area that was a problem with that public memorandum. The third problem was the fact that there was no bank financing in place. Well, the reason there wasn't bank financing in place was because this lien claim had come forward. And the reason the lien claim came forward, we contend, was because of the negligence in the on behalf of the attorneys in not challenging that lien. So we had some securities violations. There was no question about that. My client knew there were security violations, at least when they were told to her that there were security violations. She accepted that fact that, well, maybe they were. But the interesting part is that the defendant attorneys represented her before the Securities Commission, and they challenged whether or not there was security violations. So that was a real issue.
What was the basis of their challenge to whether or not there were indeed any security violations?
I'm not a securities lawyer, but the question is whether or not the notes and mortgages constituted a security. My understanding is that that's a real issue that could have been challenged. The commission stated that they were a security and that by raising that money with the notes and mortgages, that was a security. And they said it wasn't.
And indeed, it was the amended or new notes and mortgages that were drafted that was the basis of the allegation of the criminal complaint, the 13 charges. That is, that these new notes and mortgage represent a security that's being sold.
That is correct. And those were clearly drafted by the defendant attorneys, and there was a very serious question by our expert with regard to what was offered here as to whether or not they should have been redrafted at that time, because once they were redrafted, they became a blinking red light to the Securities Commission, and there they made that the basis of their complaint against her. That and the fact that her securities licenses had been turned in, and the fact that that lien had been of record and wasn't disclosed.
But ultimately, as I understand, the Securities Commission allowed the sale, but they had to be sold to a certain select group of people whose assets were, I believe, in excess of $1 million, and your client was unable to find it. So they structured it so that she could not sell to, let's say, the people that she had been selling to.
Exactly. They had the first public memorandum was accepted, and then they go back and they say, well, wait a minute, this contains three mistakes. We're going to withdraw that, and they then allow the public memorandum to go forward, but made it so difficult that my client was unable at that point to find any investors who met the criteria that they wanted, which I think was $1 million net worth, et cetera.
This is a perhaps a side issue, but it's causing me some confusion. If the basis of the charge, a criminal complaint, is, hey, look, the drafting of the new notes and mortgage is a
security, and she voluntarily surrendered her security license on unrelated matters, and so she couldn't sell securities. If that's the basis of the complaint, the criminal complaint, then how can the Securities Commission allow her in the new memorandum to sell securities, but only to people with a net worth of at least $1 million? I mean, either she, without a license, she can do it or she can't do it. I mean, it seems to me a little inconsistent, so help me with that. Maybe
I don't know as I can, Your Honor. She had turned in her license. The security in this memorandum said, okay, we're going to allow for the sale of stock in this company to go ahead with this memorandum, provided that the investors have these certain conditions. But she was allowed to sell the stock, but at the same time they held that she was in violation for not following the rules with regard to those three matters that I told you about.
Counselor, you didn't discuss, nor did anybody else really, Hicks versus Nunnery, which is a malpractice action that is brought in the context of a conviction where the defendant claimed that he was only convicted of a crime because of the malpractice of his attorneys. And in that case, the Court of Appeals said that in order to prevail on such a malpractice action, you had to prove your innocence. How are you going to get around that burden when you're admitting here today that there were securities violations and she was convicted of securities violations?
Well, the key word there, Your Honor, is convicted. There is a vast difference in the law between a conviction, which means, and that's why we're talking about issue preclusion. That goes to the very concept of trying the lawsuit, having the jury come back and convict someone under these certain facts, which is totally litigated, versus a plea. And as we point out quite extensively in our brief, a plea is different than a conviction, because the law recognizes that there are many reasons why a person would enter a plea of guilty, and we set them out, I think, quite clearly in our brief. And that's the difference in the distinction between a plea and a conviction.
Now, I understand that for issue preclusion, and I'm going to ask opposing counsel some questions about that I'm concerned with. But my concern is more basic than that. Maybe I just misunderstood what you said this morning, but I thought that what you said is that she admits that she violated the securities law. And I took that to mean that she admitted it for the purposes of the criminal matter, and also she knew that that was the case. I mean, she wasn't challenging that any further before us. Am I wrong about that? So you're saying that, see, in my view, under Hicks versus Nunnery, she's got to prove she's innocent of securities violations, right? And if you have the opportunity to do that at the trial court, that's one question.
Now, I don't believe that's correct, Your Honor.
You don't think so? Okay, no, that's what I want you to talk to me about. Why?
Well, I don't believe that she has a duty. She has entered a plea of guilty and has, by doing so, admitted that she violated some securities law.
Okay, and that may be the case, okay? But what I'm saying to you is if you're suing the attorneys for malpractice, and one of your claims is that she violated these laws based on their advice. So is it your position then because she had advice and violated the laws based on the advice that she's not then somehow guilty of these laws?
No. My position is that they are precluded from raising her plea of guilty as a total defense by the concept of issue preclusion or equitable estoppel. And as we point out in our brief, the matter of her plea can go to the jury, and it is evidence that can be used against her, but it should not be preclusive evidence. It shouldn't be estoppel evidence.
Right.
But we can then bring that fact out, and we can then talk about the fact that, well, wait a minute, I didn't know what I was doing here. This is a very complex securities matter. This is what the lawyers told me I could do, and this is what I did. And when I did it, whoops, I'm guilty of securities law.
So you're saying she acted only on advice of counsel in regard to those things that she did that eventually were held to violate the securities laws?
That is correct.
Okay, thank you very much.
Counsel, it seems to me we have an odd situation here, and I think my concern is we have to be more precise. She was never found guilty of security law violation, as I understand the record. And so correct me, because I was looking for the amended information when this case was plea bargained down from 13 counts to 5 counts, 13 felony counts down to 5 counts, as I understand it, 3 being misdemeanors, amended to misdemeanor theft by fraud, and 2 of the original felony charges of security violation remained. As I understand the record, although, as I said, I couldn't find it in the materials presented, that she was, except for the minutes of the plea hearing, she was never found guilty of securities. She was never found guilty of securities violation. What she was found guilty of and what she was sentenced on are 3 misdemeanor theft by fraud charges.
That is correct, Your Honor. The court has withheld conviction on the securities charges. We point that out in page 9 of our brief. And not only did the court withhold conviction on the felony security counts, but it was pending her making 100% restitution to the note holders in the amount of $524,000 through these legal proceedings. That matter is still pending.
The Court of Appeals took you to task, as I read the opinion, I don't mean you, but that, hey, we don't have in the record the plea transcript, and we don't have in the record the sentencing transcript, so that we cannot fully address certain issues, and then, well, you had the burden of having the full transcript, and so we'll rule against you. How do you respond to that?
I respond by saying that I didn't think the transcripts were necessary, that what we did was advise the court what the lower court had done with regard to those charges and what the ultimate result was, and we've set forth that in our brief. In a perfect world, should I have had that transcript? Perhaps.
You didn't argue, nor did the other side argue, as I understand the facts of this case, issue preclusion, either the trial court or the Court of Appeals. Is that correct? That's what the Court of Appeals opinion says, and I want to know if that's correct, because I didn't know
that. I don't think that's correct at all. I think that the matter of issue preclusion has been argued from the time that the defendants moved for summary judgment in this case right through the present time. The other issue was the matter of the bankruptcy. The corporation that was formed was forced to file bankruptcy because this lien claim and the sum of $900,000 was out there, and they were foreclosing on it. And the only way to avoid that foreclosure was to file bankruptcy, and that bankruptcy, in fact, was filed. Mallory and Zimmerman were named as a potential lawsuit in that bankruptcy, and the bankrupt court then eventually, and the bankrupt court even encouraged the trustee. He said, look, you've got 2 problems here. You've got to disgorge some of the proceeds that a certain creditor had received, and you also should go after Mallory and Zimmerman. The trustee then decided to abandon the claim against Mallory and Zimmerman. And the trustee did that for a lot of reasons. legal malpractice cases, as I know and as this court knows, and certainly as Mr. Anderson knows, are rather complicated procedures that involve tremendous amount of time by efforts, tremendous amount of out-of-pocket expenses, depositions, et cetera. And the trustee said, hey, I'm just going to abandon this and turn this back to the creditor. And that's what he did. And it is our contention that that abandonment of that claim by the trustee, in effect, put the claim back in the hands of Ms. Mrozak to pursue as she did in this litigation.
Why isn't the trustee and your client in privity, and that she is bound by the trustee's abandonment of this claim?
Because that's not the law. The law, what's that?
Why not?
Because the law gives the trustee the right to pursue or not pursue the case as he wants. The law gives the trustee the right to abandon the case, and abandonment is a term of art in the bankruptcy court. And the law clearly says that once he abandons it, it goes back to her. And even though the bankruptcy is over, then she has the right to pursue it.
Are you inferring that this was a rather casual abandonment? In other words, you said we know how malpractice cases go, and he or she did not want to tackle this. Is that
well, what word did you use, Your Honor?
Casual.
Casual. I don't think it was a casual decision. It's a decision.
Was it well thought out?
I think he determined that given the facts and circumstances, he was.
It had no merit. Isn't that what he?
No, I don't think he ever had said it had no merit. I don't think you'll find that anywhere in the record where he said it had no merit. He said that he didn't want to pursue it. And I don't think he did it casually or did it for any reason other than those are difficult cases. And as a trustee in bankruptcy, he felt he had fulfilled his duty to the creditors by doing what he did. And by fulfilling that duty and sending it back to her, he felt that he was fulfilling his duty.
Counselor, isn't one of the things a trustee in bankruptcy looks at when he or she examines the claims is what it's going to cost to collect on them and the probability of collection, and then make a determination about whether it's in the best interest of the estate or not to proceed?
Absolutely.
Is there anything in the record before us that gives us an idea of whether the trustee in bankruptcy in this case went through that process?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think that you can infer that from the fact that there was a competent trustee who was appointed and who made numerous appearances, who reported to the court and eventually reported to the court that I'm going to abandon this. I think you can infer that without, if I had a better world, would I have had an affidavit from the trustee in this record, which might have said all of the things that are being raised here? Yes. Lawyers don't live in a perfect world until they get in front of the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court says, why didn't you do this? And you say, oh, my goodness, why didn't I? So,
thank you.
My yellow light is on.
Mr. Skemp, before you move away from the bankruptcy area, let me just clarify. You indicated earlier that the corporation filed for bankruptcy. Did your client file also? Was it a double filing?
No, Your Honor. Just the corporation.
Well, then, how does the claim get back to your client individually?
My client is the sole owner of that corporation, and it comes back to her as the owner of the corporation. The trustee acknowledged the fact that by giving it back, he was giving it back to her as the sole stockholder of that corporation.
So the other people that bought stock or that had notes and mortgages, they were totally foreclosed from any interest in the corporation?
No. The court specifically stated that if that is a viable claim, and the court in the criminal matter stated that any recovery of the money out of this Mallory and Zimmerman lawsuit must go to those investors. That's the purpose of this lawsuit, basically. And I just want to point out one thing. My client never gained 5 cents from anything that she did in this case. She raised money for the prospect of putting this motel together. None of it was ever for her benefit. As a matter of fact, $35,000 of what she raised went to Mallory and Zimmerman in payment of their fees. Mallory and Zimmerman accepted those fees at the same time they argued in the lower court that they didn't know anything about the fact that she was raising this money.
In light of the fact, I didn't understand your response to Justice Crooks. In light of the fact that there were other shareholders, why would she be the only shareholder that gets this claim?
They were shareholders, they were note holders.
Because she's the only shareholder who was represented by Mallory and Zimmerman. She was represented individually and as the owner of all of the stock in Mallory and Zimmerman. The other shareholders are not owners of stock.
Yeah, Counselor, they're just note holders, aren't they? They are not shareholders of the
corporation. That's right. I thought that's what I just said.
Yeah, well, I think that we're using the terms a little bit loosely because there's a difference in the two, certainly, and there's a difference in who has a right to proceed on these claims. So there was one shareholder in the corporation, but there were several folks who lent money. Those were the securities that were sold, and they were they had mortgaged interest in the property at one point. Now they don't have any securities.
They are no
corporation debt. Still owes them a debt.
That is correct.
So, I'm sorry, why weren't they dusted off in bankruptcy?
Excuse me?
Why weren't they dusted off in bankruptcy? I mean, the corporation went through a bankruptcy. Why weren't their debts dusted off the corporation?
Because they still claim that Trish Mrozek, who was not involved in the bankruptcy, owes them that money, and because she wants to bring this lawsuit for purposes of reimbursing them and paying them back.
She has this hanging over her, doesn't she? Isn't a condition of the plea that was entered into and a reason that the and I'm arguing, again, there's no transcript, and the reason that the conviction, entry of convictions for security fraud were deferred is because she was placed on probation. Conditions of probation included incarceration and also the payment of restitution of $524,000.
Exactly. Exactly. My red light is on.
Thank you, Mr. Skemp. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you.
Attorney Ross A. Anderson, representing Intra Financial Corporation at all.
Thank you, Your Honor, and I need to correct that. I don't represent Intra Financial Corporation. I represent Mallory and Zimmerman SC.
Okay.
Intra Financial Corporation and James Graves, the contractor of this motel project, were initially sued by Mr. Skemp, but then they were released by stipulation, and they have not participated in this case.
The notes on the oral argument sheet, which you may or may not have you
no problem.
Misrepresenting.
No problem whatsoever. At least I can remember who my client is. That's always a good start.
First step, counsel.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Let me back up and just address a couple of things, if I can, that were said by Mr. Skemp during oral argument. He is correct. There are major factual disputes between the Mallory and Zimmerman firm and Patricia Mrozek and Plover Motel, Inc., PMI, over what was told to them, what was disclosed to them, and how the representation proceeded. Those factual disputes, however, are not determinative on the summary judgment motion that was granted by the trial court, because of the legal issues that were involved. Justice Bradley asked whether or not issue preclusion was argued to the trial court and the Court of Appeals on the first issue, and you're correct, it was not argued directly. The way that we framed that was with the argument that Patricia Mrozek could not prove causation against the Mallory and Zimmerman firm by virtue of her guilty plea. What we have by virtue of the guilty plea and by virtue of the plea colloquy that the trial judge conducted in order to accept the guilty plea was an admitted intentional tortfeasor. She admitted that she intended to defraud these people, she admitted knowledge of it, and she admitted that she did it by virtue of pleading guilty. She did not plead no contest. She did not enter an Alford plea. She pled guilty, and the judgment was entered. She is now suing Mallory and Zimmerman for negligence. As this court knows, an intentional tortfeasor's conduct cannot be compared against a negligence tortfeasor's conduct. Once you're an intentional tortfeasor, that's it. So the argument that was advanced to Judge Fleischauer at the trial court and also the Court of Appeals was that she was precluded from establishing the necessary element of causation on a legal malpractice claim.
That's what I understood your argument to be. Paragraph 14 of the Court of Appeals opinion states that. This is my problem with this, and help me if you can. Your argument is, look, she pled to misdemeanor theft by fraud. One of the elements of theft by fraud is intentional deceit. She intended to deceive.
That's correct.
Because that is an element and the plea was entered on that charge, that the issue of causation is precluded in the subsequent civil case. That is that she is unable to satisfy the essential element of causation in a negligence, a malpractice action because of her plea to the charge which contained those elements. I mean, that's what you're arguing. It's the whole causation thing that is precluded, right?
That was my argument, and then I was corrected by the Court of Appeals that I should have argued issue preclusion.
Well, but you still have to determine what issue is precluded, and I think that was your argument.
It was, and my argument was that the issue that is precluded is causation and damages.
Which is an essential element to maintain a cause of action in negligence, and that's
exactly
what your argument
exactly
was. Now, this is my problem. In Wisconsin, and the Court of Appeals picked up on this, and you referenced the Butler case, and the Butler case talks about the proximate cause. And the Court of Appeals says, yeah, but in Wisconsin we don't talk about the proximate cause, that we just talk about a cause. And so why is the question of whether or not the law firm's alleged negligence is a cause of the damages? Why was that issue even addressed, much less fully litigated, in the criminal action? I mean, because you can have many causes. In the criminal action, it would be your argument that she was a cause has been litigated. But my question is, why is the issue of whether or not their actions were a cause? Why was that litigated? I don't understand why that issue was litigated, because there's more than one, can be more than one cause.
Yeah, and let me try to answer that question as closely as I can. I think that you're mixing claim preclusion and issue preclusion. Issue preclusion does not require that Mallory and Zimmerman's conduct have been litigated in the criminal proceeding. Issue preclusion precludes Patricia Morozik from claiming that she's not guilty. If you look at the affidavit submitted by Mr. Skemp, or from his client submitted by Mr. Skemp, she's saying, I didn't know I did anything wrong. I just did what the law firm told me to do. That is diametrically opposed to what she pled at the, in the criminal proceeding. What the Court of Appeals said when they discussed my causation argument was that Wisconsin does not deal solely or with a sole cause and tends to stay away from proximate cause.
Mm-hmm.
The Court of Appeals is right. Wisconsin deals with substantial factors and looks at multiple causation of injury. But that's between negligent tortfeasors. We have an intentional tortfeasor here. We have an admitted intentional tortfeasor here. And that takes away the substantial factor argument that Mallory and Zimmerman's negligence may have contributed to this, because by virtue of her admission that she's an intentional tortfeasor, their negligence cannot be compared with her intentional conduct which caused the injuries that she's claiming.
Now, that may be your argument, but that's nothing that the Court of Appeals relied upon in their discussion, intentional versus negligent at all.
No, you're absolutely right. The Court of Appeals went to issue preclusion and said that she is precluded as a matter of policy and as a matter of law from recanting her guilty plea. Because there was a substantial or a significant enough evidentiary basis by virtue of the plea colloquy that's required by the statutes and by the case law that the trial judge conduct in order to confirm that it was a knowing and willing admission of guilt and that there was a waiver of constitutional rights and that there was a significant, there was a conduct to establish that the crime had been committed, that was sufficient to meet the previously litigated requirement for issue preclusion.
I beg your indulgence on this, just for clarification, and the Court's indulgence also. If the issue in malpractice is whether or not the law firm's alleged negligence was a cause of the damages here being incurring attorney's fees, having to pay $524,000 in restitution, and also a separate loss of future profits. If that's the issue that has, one of the issues that has to be addressed, and it's the issue of focus here in this case, tell me how that issue, whether or not the law firm's alleged negligence was a cause of damages. How was that, where in the record do you find that that issue was addressed in the guilty, by virtue of the guilty plea?
Well, number one, it wasn't addressed because the criminal proceeding, one of the issues in the criminal proceeding was not Mallory and Zimmerman's alleged negligence. Mm-hmm. Number two, if in fact that statement is true, then advice of counsel would have been a defense to the intentional criminal claim that she was pleading guilty to. She elected to waive that. She was represented by another attorney. It could have been an issue had advice of counsel been raised as a defense and had they gone to trial. She decided not to do that. Issue preclusion.
Well, so was the issue of the alleged negligence causing damages, was that actually litigated? The law firm's causal connection, was that actually litigated in the plea?
No, it was not.
But that's one of the elements of issue preclusion, that it was litigated.
The element of issue preclusion is that the what you're attempting to preclude was actually litigated. What we're attempting to preclude is Ms. Mrazek's recanting of her guilt.
Well, if you sure, you want to say it that way because you get within both the Court of Appeals and that this was litigated, namely her guilt. But underlying that is, your answer is that the lawyer's, Mallory's, advice could have been a defense, and she waived it.
Yes.
That was what your answer was. And so you're saying that's irrelevant because she's recanting guilt, and guilt was litigated.
Correct. Guilt was litigated, and therefore she cannot recant in a subsequent civil proceeding in order to establish negligence of another party.
Well, claim preclusion doesn't work in that because the parties are not the same or in privity, right?
That's correct.
Under claim preclusion, all issues, whether litigated or not, would be fini.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Issue preclusion doesn't matter about the parties.
That's
the
correct.
General rule.
Well, it would matter about one party, but not both.
Okay. At least one party was in that lawsuit. But that the issue has to be actually litigated, right?
Yes.
And your concept is under at least fairness, she should not be allowed to, and fairness plays a role in issue preclusion.
It does. I believe that the role that it plays is kind of a second-tier evaluation of it. If you're going to go back to the Michelle T. versus Crozier case where those elements of fairness
first
are laid out.
First you find the elements, and you say the elements are here.
Yeah, and I think those fairness elements come in because issue preclusion is a discretionary determination by the court. And although the elements may be present, the court may decide in its discretion that it's not fair to preclude the evidence in this particular case. And that's why the Court of Appeals went through, first of all, the analysis that the elements of issue preclusion are met, including the already litigated requirement, and then they went through the five or six fairness factors that the Michelle T. versus Crozier case came from the Supreme Court.
She asked on the plea colloquy whether she had that her, or she told that all of her, that her plea of guilty will waive any defenses?
I do not know, because all we have is the record that was before us that we could find. And the Court of Appeals concluded that the sufficient statutory requirements had been met from that.
Mr. Anderson, if I could, I always believed, and correct me if I'm wrong, that one of the differences between a guilty plea and a no-contest plea was that a guilty plea could be used as an admission against you in a civil proceeding, where a no-contest plea could not be used as an admission. How do you get from admission to preclusion?
You get from admission to preclusion by what is being argued, okay? If the defendant is actually trying, if the criminal defendant is actually trying to recant and change the admission that I committed the elements of this crime, then you get to preclusion. That's more than just admitting a guilty plea against the party. As an example, if someone were driving under the influence and pled guilty to that, in a subsequent negligence action against the driver for damages by the injured party, the guilty plea could be introduced as evidence that the party was negligent. The Evans versus Cameron case, where the driver pled guilty to driving under the influence and then in the subsequent civil trial said, I wasn't driving at all. It was my girlfriend who was driving, even though he had admitted, it was not an admission, it was a trial that went through, and they concluded that he was driving under the influence. He was estopped from, or he was precluded from changing the conviction that he had been driving. In this case, we've gone over to the closer to the Evans versus Cameron standard, where this is not a party who is suing her for damages and saying the guilty plea is admissible to prove that you did wrong. If her defense in that suit too was, oh, I didn't do wrong at all because I didn't know what I was doing, I was relying on what my lawyers told her, I think one of those note holders could also plead preclusion because she's admitted that she defrauded those people.
But would the fact that she's admitted, wouldn't that be evidence that would be introduced against her? I guess I'm having trouble with the concept that a plea constitutes actual litigation, at least as I think it was 30 states have recognized.
What the Court of Appeals said was not just a plea would be considered necessary actual litigation, but that if the court has met the evidentiary requirement of establishing that the basis for the plea exists, then it meets the quote-unquote actually litigated, because there's no real definition of what is to litigate something. And now I got off track there, and I think I forgot exactly what you asked. But in any event, that's where the Court of Appeals was going on that issue.
Can I just clarify? Is it your position that there are 30 states that have held that a entry of a guilty plea constitutes actual litigation?
No, the 30 states came from Mr. Skim's brief.
Yeah.
Well, let me just ask Justice Butler's question this way. And I'm trying to think of a fact situation, so I'll propose this one. The defendant is charged with, you can take intentional homicide, or you can take battery. That's an intentional crime. Pleads guilty. There's then a lawsuit of wrongful death, or under the battery, a suit for the hitting as a tort. I always thought that in those cases, the plea of guilty could be used as an admission against him, against the defendant. Following your line of argument, and I recognize there may be two, that the tort also may be intentional and your negligence, but following your line of argument, the defendant would be precluded in the tort case.
Only if there's a denial of the elements of the crime that formed the basis of the plea. What you're talking about...
He pled guilty.
And thereby admitted that he committed the elements of the crime.
Yeah.
And if he then attempts to recant and say, I didn't do it, I didn't commit the crime, he's precluded. What you're talking about is...
That's what you're saying is precluded. I always thought that was an admission. And I think that's the point of Justice Butler's question.
Well, and what that gets to is the basis of why do we have issue preclusion, what used to be collateral estoppel in the first place, and that's to avoid the repetition of litigating the same issues. If it's already been litigated, as the Court of Appeals found, then it shouldn't have to be litigated again. And
is there a difference between being litigated and being determined or resolved?
I don't believe so, as long as the safety net that the Court of Appeals constructed by requiring that the trial court conduct the plea colloquy and convince itself that the evidentiary basis for the crime was there, then that meets the litigated standard.
Mm-hmm. What does to litigate mean, do you think?
Well, that's an interesting question, and I actually tried to find an answer to that, and I really, you know, you can look up litigate in the dictionary if you want to.
I do. That's why I'm asking you.
if I start a lawsuit and it's resolved by stipulation in order for dismissal on the merits, I have litigated. And I think that I am precluded by virtue of that dismissal order that enters on the stipulation of doing some things. To me, I've litigated that. Did it go to trial? No, it didn't. So I don't think that it needs to go to trial. I think within this context, though, that where you're arguing issue preclusion, where you say, I don't think that this woman should be allowed to change her testimony on this issue, I think there is some requirement that there at least have been a judicial determination that she was making a knowing and willing admission that she had done it, and that there was an evidentiary basis for it.
Counselor,
and the Court of Appeals concluded there was. I'm sorry.
No. Are you finished with
your
answer?
I'm finished.
Okay. I have some concerns about whether a Court of Appeals can apply issue preclusion in the first instance. And they say in their opinion that it was not argued to them, and they say it was not argued to the trial court. And my concern is this, so I put my perspective on the questions I'm going to ask you. Parts of issue preclusion are decided as a matter of law. So you can tell if the person that was subject to the criminal action had an opportunity to appeal, okay? But parts of it are discretionary with the trial court. And one part that bothers me in this place is that the trial court wasn't asked to exercise its discretion about whether, A, she might have had a different reason for pleading guilty than she would have now for proceeding with this action. And if, in fact, she pled guilty on a deal that the felonies were going to be held up in the air and she could try to get restitution together, isn't that a different circumstance than her now trying to litigate the advice she was giving and the possible malpractice by the Mallory firm?
I don't think it is a different circumstance because of this.
Okay.
She may have had whatever reason she had for pleading guilty, and there's nothing in the record as to why, except for her affidavit that said she wanted to put it behind her
and attempt to
get some restitution to these people. She told me in her deposition, which is a part of our brief that was submitted to the trial court, that she thought the sale of the motel coming out of the bankruptcy was going to be enough to do the restitution so that she'd be off the hook. But in any event, she made the decision on the advice of her attorney to go ahead and plead guilty. There's nothing in the record that links the Mallory and Zimmerman to anything to do with that plea.
And that's my problem. How could the trial court exercise its discretion and say the circumstances were the same, her motivation was the same in pleading guilty, as her motivation is to retry certain issues in this action if there's no record before the trial court? How does the trial court evaluate that?
But under issue estoppel, the motivation is less of a difference than the actually litigated requirement. If I'm going to take
it is one of the fairness factors. It is one of the fairness factors that we've quoted and quoted. And I mean, the trial court could have made a decision on it if it were asked and if there were a record. But there is no record, and the trial court made no decision. So my concern is, how do I evaluate whether the Court of Appeals says the trial court properly exercised its discretion if the trial court was never asked to address the question?
The Court of Appeals reviewed Judge Fleischauer's extensive oral decision and concluded that, in essence, he had exercised his discretion by evaluating the content of the record relating to the guilty plea.
But he never had the question presented to him. So how can you exercise your discretion on a question if it's never been presented to you?
You are correct, except that the issue that was presented to Judge Fleischauer was that she cannot prove causation because she admitted that she was guilty. Ms. Mrazek put into evidence at the trial court on the summary judgment motion saying, I may have admitted I was guilty, but I had other reasons for doing it, and I wanted to go after the Mallory and Zimmerman firm. And Judge Fleischauer looked at that and looked at the actual record and concluded that the guilty plea had been entered and that she had admitted that she committed this intentional defrauding of these people.
Right, but getting back to Justice Bradley's question, that's a different issue than the issue that's before us in the malpractice action.
It is and it isn't. You're correct that the malpractice issue involves a different, broader issue, but what issue preclusion says is people don't get two different kicks at the cat and they don't get to take two positions before the court. And
they do if they have different motivations in two different proceedings. That's one of the fairness factors that the trial court is supposed to look at.
If you're talking about the fairness factors from Michelle T. versus Crozier, I'm not sure that the motivation is a fairness factor. What Michelle T. versus Crozier asks if there were distinctly different claims.
It says whether there are individual circumstances that would have caused the party against issue preclusion, against whom issue preclusion is sought to be applied, to have them plead guilty in one and now proceed in a civil action in another stance.
Yes, but if you are going to allow this situation to fall under that fairness factor, then you are going to allow people to assume one position before a court if that suits their purpose, and then immediately assume another position before a court if that suits their purpose and say, oh, I had another reason for doing that. You can't preclude me from taking a different position.
Well, I think that there may be ways around that, but I think they have to be presented to the trial court to make a determination on. I guess that's my major concern with your argument.
Well, and where I think the Court of Appeals came down on that was because she pled guilty and did not plead no contest, that she made a knowing and willing decision to take the position before the court that I am guilty of these crimes. And now she cannot. She's precluded from coming into another court and saying, I'm not guilty of these crimes. You're the one who caused this.
Counsel, I think that we have to start with the basics here, because what I see playing out is the intermingling of several different theories and avenues of analysis. The basics are, one theory, let me just put those forward, one theory is issue preclusion, which requires certain elements, and then application of the Michelle T. five-factor fairness test. That's one theory of analysis.
Right.
Another theory of analysis is, hey, forget issue preclusion, forget Michelle T., and just do it on public policy. The Court of Appeals also took that approach in the in peri delicto and said, essentially, we're not going to allow this to happen as a matter of public policy because you did something immoral and wrong and now you can't benefit by it.
Right.
That's another analysis.
Right.
Another form of analysis is that which you find in the comments and the restatements or the Federal Rules of Procedure commentary. That is employing judicial estoppel, not collateral estoppel, issue preclusion, but judicial estoppel, which has three elements. And in large part kind of gets down to, you know, is it fair too? But there are three different modes of analysis. What the Court of Appeals did here was, when I say we have to get back to the foundation, it never went through the very basic issue preclusion analysis. It said there are many elements in issue preclusion. Actually litigated is one of them, and then addressed actual litigated. What are the other elements of issue preclusion? Before you get to Michelle T., before you get to applying fairness, what are the elements of issue preclusion? And let me, because I see you're trying to, I have a case that was cited by the Court of Appeals and cited in the briefs, James case versus Paul, which is the Missouri case that's relied upon. They set forth the elements of issue preclusion. Let me help you with that to see if you agree.
I've got it here, because Northern States Power Company versus Berger, I think, is the leading Wisconsin case.
That's
it's
right.
A 1995 case. Issue preclusion forecloses relitigation in a subsequent action of an issue of law or fact that has actually been litigated and decided in a prior action. And that's primarily the elements of issue preclusion. The actual litigation was the one that the Court of Appeals focused on.
But what are the other ones besides actual litigation?
Well, certainly that there have been the same party who was attempting to change the position that is being precluded against, and that it had been in a prior action. Decided in a prior action.
Well, that's actually litigated. James puts these as the basic elements. I'm not sure they are in Wisconsin. Number one, the basic elements for issue preclusion. Number one, whether the issue decided in the prior adjudication was identical to the issue presented in the present case. Number two, whether the prior adjudication resulted in a judgment on the merits. Number three, whether the party against whom estoppel is asserted was a party or was in privity with a party to the prior adjudication. And number four, whether the party against whom collateral estoppel, claim preclusion, is asserted had a full and fair opportunity to litigate the issues in the prior case. Are those the elements of issue preclusion in the state of Wisconsin?
I think if you read the Northern States Power case, you would find that they are all in there, and I think you would find they are here. The identical issue is that in the criminal proceeding, she said, I was guilty, I defrauded these people. Here she's not. Same issue, her conduct. The second is, was there a judgment on the merits? Yes, she was convicted. The third is, was she a party? Yes, she was the defendant. And the fourth is the actual actually litigated requirement, which we've talked a fair amount about.
But I thought, already indicated that the issue of whether or not the law firm's alleged negligence caused damage was not litigated.
But that's not the issue that's being precluded. The issue that's being precluded is her ability to recant the fact that she committed fraudulently took money from these people, and that's what caused the damage in the criminal conviction. That's the issue that's being precluded, not Mallory and Zimmerman's negligence.
But didn't you tell Justice Bradley a while ago that she could have raised Mallory and Zimmerman's advice as a defense to that exact admission?
She could have. Advice of counsel can be a defense to the commission of an intentional crime.
All right, that's true. So then I guess I don't see why the issue Justice Bradley identifies isn't the issue we have to be concerned with as we look at the application of issue preclusion.
Because Mallory and Zimmerman's negligence is not the issue being precluded, we are attempting to preclude her recanting of the fact that her admission that she did this and that she intended to do it. If you look at the elements of 943.20, it's that she did it knowingly and that she intended to defraud these people. That's what she's admitted, and on the basis of that record, she can't establish negligence in getting her to that point.
Thank you.
And my red light is on. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Skemp.
Kind of hard to know where to begin. I think the first place that I will begin is to address Justice Bradley's question of what constitutes litigating. And I think that the law is rather clear when it recognizes the difference between a plea of guilty and a conviction. They talk about a conviction as the matter having been litigated, and as I would understand litigation, it means going to the trier of facts, either the court or the jury, and actually getting a determination by the trier of facts as to the result of the conduct.
Mr. Skip, I don't mean to be picky, but I think even with a guilty plea, you get a conviction. I think what you're trying to distinguish is a guilty plea in a trial on the merits. You get a conviction either way.
Well, you get a conviction, but I don't think that you have the matter litigated.
That's a separate issue. I grant you that.
I'm sorry if I
want to make sure we're talking the same language here.
Confused myself.
All right.
Questions were raised as to whether or not there was ever a judgment on the merits with regard to a plea. I don't think that the court reached that point when the court says, well, I'm going to withhold the conviction because I want to have you have the opportunity to make 100% restitution to the note holders through the legal proceedings against Mallory and Zimmerman. In other words, this lawsuit was well known to the court at the time, and the court said, I'm going to withhold that pending your going forward with this. And that's, of course, what we're trying to do here. We're being met with very substantial resistance. I think if I were to go back...
On the security fraud counts?
Excuse me?
That's on the security fraud counts?
Yes. I think if I would go back and look at anything in the briefs, both counsel's briefs and the questions that are asked here, there's one word that keeps popping up, and that's the question of fairness. And I think when we're talking about fairness here, we're talking about a rather complicated securities matter in which she is following the advice of attorneys who tell her she can or cannot do things. She does them and then says before the lower court and says throughout all these proceedings, oh, my gosh, I didn't know that what I was doing was wrong, but what I was doing was following the advice of my lawyers. The dissent in the Butler case talks about fairness, and I love the language of the dissent in the Butler case, the main case that's on in our brief, set forth rather extensively. And throughout these questions and throughout these briefs, I think if we focus on the question of what is fair to my client under these circumstances, and is it fair for a lawyer to give this kind of advice which puts her in this kind of a box and then walk away and say, well, you might have followed our advice, but you pled guilty and you committed the crime and we have no responsibility.
That's well, we told your client, though, not to plead guilty, didn't it? Didn't the law firm say don't plead guilty?
I'm unaware of that, Your Honor.
She never consulted.
Mallory Zimmerman did not represent her in all fairness.
I know that. Yeah. But no conversation with Mallory?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay.
The law firm took the position, as I recall, counsel, that there was no securities violation.
They did. They represented her before the Securities Commission, and they took that position. And to this day, I think they take that position. There was no securities violation. But unfortunately, a lot of events have intervened, and a lot has happened to my client as a result of this unbelievable sequence of events. Counsel has been asked about the other things that could have been done here, a plea of no contest or an offered plea. In the bankruptcy case, should the trustee have done this and that? There are a lot of lawyers that are handling a lot of things. And my client is sitting out there listening to these lawyers and doing these things. And as a result, her life is at stake and prison is at stake. And in all fairness, shouldn't she have the opportunity to go back to the lower court, try this case, litigate the case, litigate it to conclusion, and get a court or jury determine the relative
fault of herself and that law firm. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Skemp, and thank you, Mr. Anderson, for another case before the court this term relating to issue preclusion. Your arguments have been very informative. That concludes our hearing on 02-2448, Rozak versus Intra Financial Corporation et al. The court will take a few moments recess so that the students may leave and other students may enter the courtroom.
Thank you.